Steve Jobs' sister was at his bedside when he died 4 years ago. She wrote that his last words were, "Oh wow, oh wow, oh wow." Trying to capture his spirit in those words, she wrote them in all caps without punctuation. Well, I can't really say that I'd given his death much thought until something happened to me that made me think about it. A month ago, I was invited to give the invocation at a high school commencement in Tampa. The principal was intentional about inviting a Unitarian Universalist because she knew she actually had a chance of getting an interfaith ecumenical prayer, a prayer that would best honor the students' families of multiple faith or no faith backgrounds, including Christian, by far the largest percentage, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, and atheist. She said, "We have everybody." I gave the prayer, and then the guest speaker, who was a well-known Tampa TV personality, began his commencement address. He told me earlier with some pride that he hadn't written a word. He said he thought he would talk about failure, and I thought that's always a good subject for a commencement address. He said he would say, "When you get knocked down, you have to pick yourself up." I thought, well, that sounds good. In beginning his talk, I think he did mention failure for 5 seconds. And soon he was on to other topics, including sports and religion. And soon his address began to sound like a revival, like an evangelistic Christian sermon. And soon Jesus became the topic of the sermon. And the speaker quoted Steve Jobs' last words, "Oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow." And he said, the commencement speaker said, he knew that the audience knew what Steve Jobs was, what he saw as he lay dying. He, for sure, was seeing the gates of heaven, hearing the choirs of angels. He was experiencing the power of God himself. And many in that audience broke into wild cheers, applause, and shouting of their agreement. When the commencement speaker finished this impromptu address and sat back down next to me on stage, I whispered to him, "You certainly connected to your audience." And he whispered back, "9 of my family members are Black Baptist preachers." Well, that's the experience that made me think about Steve Jobs' dying words and wondering about those assumptions, that speaker's assumptions. What can we surmise about Steve Jobs' last words? Was he having a vision of Jesus, God, and the angels, as the speaker assumed? And I decided then to begin to explore this subject and made a list of 4 questions to guide my explorations, and I'm sharing those with you. Number 1, does everyone experience the same vision at the time of death, a vision of heaven full of angels, bright light, and the figure of God in the light, or does each of our final visions depend on each of our own unique religious or a-religious orientations? When people near death are resuscitated and live to tell of their experience, what commonalities do they share regardless of their religion? And are there scientific reasons for these commonalities? And question 2, how is it that our Western culture has a deeply embedded stereotype of what heaven is supposed to look like? Is that possibly the influence of Dante's vision of heaven? Paradiso is the third book of the Divine Comedy, written in Italian in the 14th century. And question number three, how did a Unitarian and Transcendentalist like Emerson in the 19th century deal with religionists, on one hand, who pushed the traditional view of an external heaven on him, and on the other hand, how did he deal with atheists who wanted to argue with him about the divine? And a brief fourth question, why should we care? I care about this, but why should we care about this? And I think the answer is inherent in the closing words today by Ralph Waldo Emerson. So I have started to explore the answers to these questions. Does everyone in the Western tradition experience the same vision at the time of death? A vision of a heaven full of angels, bright light, and a heavenly deity. My own faith has changed over the years. As a child, I loved Jesus. I went to Sunday school every Sunday with my siblings. In the second grade, as a seven-year-old, I was sick in bed for a month. I had a high fever and a strep throat, and it was a while ago. It was in the days before penicillin was widely available. It had been invented, but it wasn't widely available. There was no widespread use of it, so I was very sick and fevered for a month. During that time, I dreamed of Jesus. I had a vision. He was coming to rescue me, and he was dressed as a cowboy. I was 7 years old. That was my world. And he was in blindingly white, shiny white, with a white cowboy hat and beautiful white boots with gold spurs. The fine horse he was riding was luminous white, too. I'm not sure where my subconscious got the cowboy part of that image. That was years before TV came to my house, and no doubt I was influenced by John Wayne cowboy movies that my grandmother took us to Saturday afternoons. But the rider on that horse in my fever dream was most certainly Jesus, my Sunday school hero. I recognized him from the picture on the bulletin board in my Sunday school class, a white Protestant-looking guy with longish hair. I recently learned that this Head of Christ painting is from a Chicago artist, Warner Salmon, who painted it in 1941. Salmon was an evangelical Christian. This was the Jesus of my dream. He was a loving and healing presence, smiling, riding a white stallion. I'm not saying my Jesus on the white horse dream was a near-death experience, although it was similar. In this way, many who have had near-death experiences report with total certainty that the primary purpose in life is to learn to love. That if you haven't learned to love, your life hasn't been of much value. My dream of Jesus, dressed hat to spurs and dazzling all white, that Jesus loved me. Jesus loves me. That much I knew as a seven-year-old. That love prevails in death and near-death experience seems to be present whether you are seven or 70. I read an account of a grandmother who had a near-death experience. There was no fear, no anxiety, she said. I seemed to be walking or going someplace. I was conscious of the fact that I had left the world and those dear to me just as much as if you walked out of a room and closed the door behind you. After walking for a time, the light seemed to be breaking through and everything seemed to be getting much lighter when suddenly a light that I have never seen anything like before broke before me and I was completely surrounded by a brilliancy that blinded me so that I could hardly see. And later, after she had made a full recovery, she told her daughter that what she had learned from the experience was, never be afraid. She said the whole experience taught her that there is nothing to fear and that everything is love. That love was light. The light was love. That overwhelming feeling of love is an experience common to all near-death experiences. Neuroscientists say that many of the characteristics of NDEs can be biologically explained. I'm going to tell you about differences. Social and medical scientists say the particular image each of us will see as we begin the dying process, these visual images will depend on our spiritual beliefs, our individual and unique images of heaven and particular deities. Many of us Unitarian Universalists are come-outers from traditional Christianity, where we once held traditional images of Jesus, God, and heaven. For example, in that dream I had as a 7-year-old, I go back to that and think that about 5 decades later, I became a Unitarian Universalist. I was influenced by Ralph Waldo Emerson's writing in that transition to becoming a UU, and very much by Zen Buddhism. I'm guessing that many of you have had a similar emergence from your religion of origin. I've read that the image of a powerful God in human-looking form in heaven, an image held by many Christians, that this was created by the poet Dante Alighieri in the 14th century. This is about 700 years ago. In the third book of the Divine Comedy trilogy, the third book is the Paradiso, Paradise, Dante tells a story of someone named Dante climbing up, ascending into heaven, into the circles of heaven. Beatrice, Beatrice was his guide. He ascends into heaven with his beloved Beatrice as his guide. She is able to look at the blinding light. Dante, not so much. He sneaks peeks at the light. He can't quite look at it because it's so bright. He averts his eyes. He describes the scene saying, I saw it sparkling all around like molten iron emerging from the fire. And suddenly it seemed that day had been added to day as if the one who can had graced the heavens with a second sun. S-U-N. Sun. Dante's vision of heaven has influenced artists in the 700 years since. His description of a brilliantly lit heavenscape has become part of our assumptions about what heaven looks like. This influence was possible because the Divine Comedy was one of the first books to be printed and widely distributed when the new technology of movable type was introduced into Italy from Germany during the 1460s and 1470s. I think that's amazing. An example of Dante's written description of heaven is evident in the painting on the cover of your order of service. It's a painting by Hieronymus Bosch, a Dutch painter, a painting called The Ascent of the Blessed. This painting was made in the late 15th century, about a century after Dante published the Divine Comedy. And at this point, I want to say how much support I had before today from everybody involved. Judy McGrath found this and suggested it for the cover, and I was just delighted with how it fits so well. And I'd like to also thank Klaus and Jim for our many emails together. Dante's poetic depiction of God in heaven also influenced Michelangelo's image of God in the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican. No doubt Michelangelo's portrayal of God with a powerful stance and flowing white beard has in turn influenced the very personal images of many people's death and near-death experiences. In the words for contemplation today, I shared with you this thought, that in Western mysticism, that is, within Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, the mystic emphasizes that this meeting is with a personal God, a God in the human soul. He is far above and beyond the world. This is the sort of God depicted in the last book of the Divine Comedy, the Paradiso, the God that is far above and beyond the world. So that, generally speaking, from Dante to Bosch, Michelangelo, is how this image of a personal God, how this big guy with a beard who is someplace far above and beyond an external, continued on to the present day in Christianity and became the central figure in some near-death and death experiences through this chain of artistic representation. So now, as we look around in this beautiful sanctuary, we don't see those same representations in this UU Church of Sarasota. We know why. I refer you to our earlier words for contemplation. In Eastern mysticism, that is Hinduism, Buddhism, and the Chinese religion, it is more usual to emphasize that the mystic experience is a total fusion with God or the cosmic spirit. You may well ask, how did Eastern mysticism enter into the Unitarian world of ideas? Well, one way was through Ralph Waldo Emerson and his circle of friends in Concord, Massachusetts in the 19th century, those transcendentalists. Emerson had to deal with those who wanted him to embrace a more traditional idea of God. That brings us to my question number 3. How did he deal with religionists on the one hand who pushed the traditional view of an external heaven on him, and on the other hand, the atheists who wanted to argue with him about any divine at all? Emerson was a skeptic, both about traditional Christianity and about atheism. I wonder, did you know, I didn't know this until a couple weeks ago, that he came to St. Augustine, Florida, to avoid the winter of 1817 and escape the cold of New England? While in St. Augustine, he pondered the existence of God and he wrote these words of skepticism in his journal. And this is Emerson's prose, not mine. It's clearly not the way we put sentences together today, but bear with me. Emerson said, "Who is he that has seen God, of whom so much is known? Satisfy me beyond the possibility of doubt of the certainty of all that is told me concerning that other world. The believer tells me he has evidence, historical and internal, which make the presumption so strong that it's almost a certainty that it rests on the highest of probabilities." Yes, but change that imperfect to perfect evidence, and I too will be a Christian. But now it must be admitted, I am not certain that any of these things are true. The nature of God, Emerson said in St. Augustine in his journal in the winter of 1817, the nature of God may be different from how it's represented. I never beheld him. I don't know that he exists. The good which invites me now is visible and specific. Well, what did Emerson mean by visible and specific? I like to think that he meant the glory of the visible and specific landscape of St. Augustine. Emerson was really into nature in the same way that the poets and painters of the 19th century in Europe, you may have heard about the Romantic movement. Doesn't mean heartthrob romantic. It means more about the soul. How much they were into nature. He was familiar with the poems and the paintings and their celebration of the landscape and of all nature, the visible and the specific, and the way we respond to nature. The visible landscape was part of his new vision of heaven. Emerson got together with his close friends Henry David Thoreau and Margaret Fuller and other transcendentalists, and they read the Eastern mystics. You may have heard about Margaret Fuller. I think she spoke and read, translated 5 languages. They read the German poets like Goethe and Schiller, who were exploring paganism and talking of landscapes. Perhaps they were also familiar with some of the landscape, European landscape painters of the era. Emerson spent time in Europe and visited art exhibits. These are examples of paintings depicting this 19th century view of heaven. Emerson and his circle were influenced not only by that European poetry and art, they were also influenced by all the Asian books they could get their hands on. They translated the Bhagavad Gita. They read Confucianism. They read Buddhist texts. The traditional images of an external heaven since Dante's writing of the Paradiso, those images were fading for these liberal Christians and the transcendentalists. This is the time that Emerson developed his idea of the oversoul. A colleague defines, you have what Emerson said about the oversoul in our reading today. A colleague in the ministry defines the oversoul like this. Emerson believed that the soul was a power in which each individual participated by adding the prefix over to the idea of a soul. He found a way to retain the sense of spirituality as an inward orientation, but also to emphasize the idea that our innermost spiritual nature is something universal, not merely personal. Question number 4. Why should we care about any of this? Emerson said, "That which dominates our imaginations and our thoughts will determine our lives and character. Therefore," this is a preview of the closing words, "therefore it behooves us to be careful what we worship, for what we are worshiping, we are becoming." It seems likely from all of this that where we are spiritually, when our time has come, is likely to determine our final conscious experiences, our moments of, oh wow, oh wow, oh wow. So if Steve Jobs wasn't experiencing what the Southern Baptist preacher commencement address speaker was saying he was experiencing, what was he experiencing? Neuroscientists would say that Steve very likely, like a lot of others, was experiencing the progression of seeing a tunnel, feeling a sense of peace, maybe a beautiful misty landscape, and very bright light In addition to that, what deity would he have experienced or seen? So far as I've been able to discover, Steve Jobs did not grow up in a Protestant Sunday school. Far from it. I don't think he was any religion at all until he, as a young man, went to India as a young adult. And then later on, he seriously studied Buddhism at a Soto Zen Center in California. In Zen, there is no worship of a deity. There is no worship of a Buddha or a god of any kind. Remember that story of heaven and hell? The enraged samurai couldn't take Hakin's insults and drew his sword. And Hakin said, "This is hell." And when the soldier put his sword away and bowed before the Zen master, he said, "And this is heaven." Like so many Zen stories, it's a riddle, a koan, a riddle without a deity that says it all. Heaven is a place of peace and pervading love. And so my blessings to you on your spiritual journeys. Peace.